The Iditarod Trail is more than 100 years old. The system has a diverse past. Originally traveled by Alaska's first peoples, gold fever then brought hundreds across it in the hopes of striking it rich. Mail, fuel, groceries, and building materials, even life-saving medicine has traveled the route. These days, it's most well known for the sled dog race that brings contestants and spectators from all over the world. Now it's been designated a National Historic Trail. What's in store for the next 100 years of the Iditarod Trail? We'll talk about it and take your calls today on Talk of Alaska Statewide.
Today's program is underwritten in part by Penn Air, operating since 1955 and providing 9 destinations with service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations and rates online at pennair.com. If you are an individual owner of Indian Trust land, an IIM account holder, or heir to an Indian Trust landowner or account holder, you may be eligible to receive money from a $3.4 billion federal settlement. To get a detailed written notice about the settlement that explains your legal rights, you may visit IndianTrust.com or call 1-800-961-6109. This message is sponsored by the Native American Trust. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters.
Good morning and welcome to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, sitting in for Steve Heimel. And today we're talking about the Iditarod Trail. Very timely, of course, because the race is coming up, starting this weekend. But there's so much more to the Iditarod Trail than the annual race, and that's what we'll be talking about today. Joining me in the studio is Kevin Keeler. Kevin is the administrator for the Iditarod National Historic Trail with the Bureau of Land Management. Good morning.
Good morning.
Thanks for being here with us. And we'll also be joined in a bit by phone from Judy Bittner, who is the president of the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance, and Leslie Schick, who is with the DNR Lands Iditarod Project. And I anticipate that we'll also hear from some folks who offer tours of the trail and take tourists out to see what it looks like. And we'd also love to take your calls and hear about I'd especially like to hear from folks who live in parts of Alaska who use the trail as maybe part of how they travel around to get in between communities. 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK is the number statewide. Locally, 550-8422. So, Kevin, there's an effort underway right now, started in 2008 for the centennial of the Iditarod Trail, 100 years old. And it's an effort that will run from 2008 to 2012. There's a lot of things going on. Tell us about some of the work that's been done since the kickoff of the centennial in 2008.
Well, the centennial commemorates the opening of the trail to the gold fields in Iditarod in 2010-2011. Literally about 100 years ago, the first heavily loaded sleds filled with gold were coming out of Iditarod down the trail over Crow Pass and then down to Seward to be shipped out on boat, and people were marching up and down the trail from roadhouse to roadhouse. The Alaska Road Commission at that time sent out a crew from Nome headed by Colonel Walter Goodwin, who was the superintendent of the Nome District for roads, Nome being one of the biggest communities, but it also needed connection to an ice-free port, and Seward wanted to be that port rather than Valdez and running the mail through Valdez. So the Road Commission sent Goodwin down, and him and a crew of about 6 people worked from Caltag through the area now known as the Anoka National Wildlife Refuge down to Iditarod, then back up to Takotna, and then from McGrath down over across the Alaska Range to Susitna Station. And they worked through the middle of winter, putting in trail markers, clearing trail, that sort of thing. And these guys were out. Basically, they didn't work when it got colder than 50 below. And
wow.
So they were out there for about 3 months, cutting trail, putting up the tripods that we see and still use out on the trails these days to mark it over the tundra section of the trail. And between that time and World War I, the trail was heavily traveled to move freight from Iditarod and back again, and for people to move in and out. There was a biannual migration of people walking in and out of Iditarod back to Seward, basically to get the heck out of the country in the wintertime because it's pretty cold country up there, bleak country. Little known fact that almost as many people, perhaps even more people, walk the trail than actually rode dog sleds. Back in those days, it was lined with old roadhouses and then later safety cabins that the Road Commission put up. The Gold Rush boom kind of expired around World War I, also driven by the Alaska Railroad being built in Anchorage. The country, a lot of the people moved out of the country down to the other jobs in Anchorage. For instance, Z.J. Lusak in Anchorage, he used to be the druggist, the pharmacist in Iditarod. The Bagoys in Anchorage, they own the only cow in Iditarod for milk. You need milk.
That would have been quite a commodity, I'm sure.
Right, yeah. Right. So those people moved. A lot of people went for the war effort in World War I, and so the gold rush was over, and that length of the trail really wasn't used that much, started to fall into disrepair. The airplane came into popularity, and people right away adapted the use of the aircraft to fly out to the gold fields and that sort of thing. So the trail went into fallow state, you might call, for a while then. And then this character by the name of Joe Reddington Sr., who lived in Kinnick and that area, had a wild idea to resurrect dog mushing and commemorate sled dogging and bring physical activity or support physical activity out in Bush, Alaska. Had this wild idea to run a race from basically Anchorage to Nome, pretty much, and use the old Iditarod Trail, because he used to be friends with the people who ran the old roadhouses and that sort of thing, learned his craft from those people who lived out there, and wanted to preserve and bring life back to this tradition. So the Iditarod Sled Dog Race was formed, and at the same time, those folks pushed for and got the designation of the Iditarod as a National Historic Trail.
How important do you think just that effort was in bringing the trail back into sort of the limelight and having efforts put into preserving it? Was anything going on before Reddington decided, hey, let's run a race?
Back in those days, from what I understand, that the culture of dog sledding was either utilitarian out in the villages still, because snow goes really didn't work as well as they do today. Or there was a sprint mushing. There was a lot of sprint mushing going on, short distance races. But people really scoffed at the thought of a 1,000-mile sled dog race. There had been a history of that with the All-Alaska Sweepstakes up out of Nome at the turn of the century. They used to run 400-mile round trip from Nome up to Candle and back again. And that's when Leonard Sepala and other mushers came to fame with dogs like Togo and teams like that that later received more fame. But there really wasn't any preservation going on per se. I mean, people were still, if there was a cabin that was habitable, they were still living in it or using it. One of the roadhouses up on the road out of Nome right now, the Cape Nome Roadhouse, it's a private dwelling, so people still live in those places and use them if they're habitable. But there wasn't this sense of the national significance of this. But it is a nationally significant trail, and that's why it got national designation, because it was the last great gold rush in North America. When you look at the history of gold rushes, they go all the way back to California and even beyond. I guess the first one was in Georgia. I'm not a gold rush historian per se, more of a trail historian. But this was the last free-for-all, yeehaw, let's go out and dig the gold. Just about any individual could do that sort of thing, and a lot of people did. They tried to move their way up to Iditarod and stake out a little piece of dirt and dig up the gold.
And I was reading just this morning that more than 50 tons of gold was hauled out. 50 tons. It's just mine.
Right.
It's staggering to consider with today's gold prices.
Yes, yes. And what
what the math would be on that.
Really amazed me was I was looking at some old pictures, and there was one photo, $200,000 of gold in Girdwood, because the main route used to be Crow Pass for a while. And then it dawned on me that, well, wait a minute, that was $200,000 back when gold was fixed at $21 an ounce. So I did the reverse math, and I realized, whoa, this is $13 million of gold on this sled here that these guys are carrying. So they used to run these gold, they called them gold trains back in those days, and there'd be two sleds, Occasionally, I think there was a record of three sleds and 41 dogs was the record. But they would carry around 1,000 pounds of gold. And there was never a successful robbery of gold on the entire Iditarod Trail. And
these guys were tough.
Right. And partly because it's the one narrow line of civilization through the countryside, and gold is extremely heavy, and you're not going to be able to carry it anywhere. There was wireless service. You know, we talk about wireless in the villages now. Well, there was wireless 100 years ago also in Iditarod. And so they would know how much gold was actually being shipped out of Iditarod, and they would radio it down to Seward, and there was the expectation. And so the things that we have, like the little, you know, some of the radio stations have caribou clatter and things like that, and, you know, send messages out, that was happening in those days. So word would travel up and down the trail. There was an expectation that the gold team was coming through, and they'd be coming up. So
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or locally in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. We're talking about the Iditarod Trail, the history of the trail, and Kevin Keeler is in the studio with me, and we're going to take a call. Pete is on the line from Fairbanks, and he wants to talk about mining roads. Hi, Pete.
Hi there. How are you?
Good.
Yeah, I just wanted to say that I think the trail is of national significance, and one of the sort of unknown developments there is this gas pipeline for the proposed Diamond Creek mine, and it's a thing that I'm sure I think a lot of people don't actually register what this means for the trail and for the region, and I just think it deserves a little bit of attention and awareness, because I really think that this could be a game changer for the region. I won't necessarily say it's good or bad. I just think it's something that needs to be brought up, and people should realize that at some point it could be an industrialized area rather than this historic and iconic sort of place. So.
Well, I'm glad that you brought that up, Pete, because I did have a question about that. There is a gas pipeline being considered for, it's my understanding, about 150 miles segment for part of what will be a 350-mile gas line for Donlin Creek. They're studying this idea for powering the gold mine operation out there. How will a proposal like this be handled along a historic route? What's in play for how this could be done and still maintain the integrity of this trail?
Before a proposal like this has to actually hits the ground, there's a fair amount of work done both on the ground and with background research in terms of identifying historic resources. There really hasn't been a recent comprehensive survey of the historic resources in Rainy Pass, for instance, and there were a number of roadhouses over Rainy Pass, it's really important to be able to document and determine where those features are and what those features are like in place before any disturbance occurs to them, because it really does lend to and answer questions that we haven't entirely resolved yet about the history of the trail and who is going over the trail. So there's that documentation, and a proponent for a project of this nature would have to basically do that sort of
baseline studies where the trail is now.
And not only that, but really detailed on the ground. Then in the case of the actual design itself, there's ways of putting the alignment in places that would either not disturb the historic route, if it is a historic route that's in question or the impacts, or might actually benefit the historic route too. And then finally, for the residual impacts that may occur, most of this is on state land, but the state would have under the State Historic Preservation Office requirements to mitigate what's going on. So, for instance, we saw over power line pass here in Anchorage, GCI a number of years ago put in a fiber optic system over. And part of their mitigation was that they improved the trail. They graveled it, they regraded it, they provided improved drainage on it, that sort of thing. So there's opportunities for that, things that might enhance people's use and encourage continued use of the trail. So it may not all be an entirely bad thing that happens out there on the ground. It's just a matter of rather than moving forward with just one objective to put a pipeline in, if all these other objectives, which is why there's laws out there and we have these dialogues in advance, why we can accomplish a number of different tasks at the same time. There's certainly a need today for improved marking on the trail. We've been working on that, but it's an extensive trail. There's a need for more and a demand for shelter on the cabin for people to be to get out there and be able to enjoy it safely.
And you've put up some new cabins. There's four new cabins.
Right.
And let's talk a little bit about how that work gets done and how it's funded. Where does the money come from to build the cabins, to put people to work out there? Where's that coming from?
Right. There's a couple different sources. One of them, the cabins and safety cabins along the trail are a long tradition. I've actually got a picture here of a safety cabin that was built back in the 20s by the Twitchells out of Henry Fowler and Joaquin, I can't remember the guy's first name, and the Twitchell, one of the founders of of Takotna. And basically, the federal government employed those folks to get out there and build these safety cabins. And in a similar way, we've been doing that. But typically, we do it on a partnership basis. We've been working, for instance, with folks in McGrath, and they built a new safety cabin. They were able to get a small amount of grant money. We were able to come up with some money to helicopter materials out to the cabin site. Then the community got together. They went out for a long weekend and put the cabin up. The cabins that you had mentioned were part of the economic stimulus program, the American Reinvestment and Recovery Act, where BLM, being in the position of the federal coordinator for this National Historic Trail, put in for money for safety cabins. And we received money for four safety cabins. And some of the other work that we'd done in the past had been kind of a dress rehearsal for that. So we saw that opportunity coming and jumped at it and were able to receive the funding for it.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or locally 550-8422 is the number to join our conversation about the Iditarod Trail that has been designated a National Historic Trail, one of only 18, I understand, in the nation. Give us a call. Let us know how you have used the trail, if you've been out on it. I'd be interested in some of those stories, especially the first people of Alaska who developed these routes and used them for traveling. And I imagine a lot of seasonal travel. It'd be great to hear some of the stories from folks that are in the villages and were some of the original ancestors of the original travelers of the trail. Joining us by phone now is Judy Bittner, who is the president of the Iditarod Historic Trail Alliance, and also Leslie Schick, who is with the DNR and working on Iditarod Project. Good morning, both Judy and Leslie. Thanks for joining us. And let's talk a little bit about, let's start with Judy, how you, the Historic Trail Alliance, is working with BLM and DNR, and what's going on during this centennial effort to improve the trail and increase marking on it. Judy?
Yes, thank you for having us on and focusing on the historic side of the Iditarod Trail. We worked with the state and federal partners, the BLM, the Chugach Forest, and the State of Alaska, and Fish and Wildlife Service, and developed what we call our centennial framework, in which we were kind of focusing on areas we call the trail, the story, and the stewardship, identifying some legacy results that we would like to accomplish working with our partners during this time. And we have been working with the community, some communities, with particularly McGrath and Takotna and Shagluk, and BLM, providing them materials and some monies to offset some of their costs with gas and all to help them mark the trails outside their communities. We're also working with the ITC, providing a grant for them, the Iditarod Trail Committee, for some of the areas around Roan. And we were they were working on that this summer when the Turquoise Fire hit. And so we shifted our priorities to the area of that fire to clear the trail, working with them. And they, in turn, working with the communities and hiring locals to clear that section of the trail that got burned and would have prohibited passage through there during this winter.
The trail is 2,400 miles, and it's my understanding there's about 1,500 of it that's currently open. And what does that mean, currently open? How usable are the 1,500 miles?
It really depends on the time of the year that people are going out there. And we have constraints that Alaska seasons put on us. It might not be the safest time of the year to go over Crow Pass right now with avalanche hazard and that sort of thing. So the Crow Pass route is a favorite summertime route for a lot of people. Same with routes through Chugach National Forest have a lot of both winter and summer use. Other segments are only usable during the winter time because so much of the interior of Alaska is swampland and you really need it to be frozen up at that time. But really depends on local partnerships, local stewardship, local use, and that's to a large degree what the plan and again the framework for the centennial for this trail have relied on is local involvement for the trail. So I'd say 1,500 miles is a good estimate of what's open and available. The race, in a sense, piggybacks onto a lot of local use that's already there, but it also helps pioneer some routes through that may not have been pioneered through. And an effort that State DNR, which Leslie Schick represents, has been involved with, I think we're going to actually find that there's more mileage than we thought out there of trail, partly because we've got more accurate maps of them now. We're able to do stuff more detailed with GPS and geographic information systems. And maybe Leslie has a comment on that, too.
Leslie, I would like to bring you in now. Thank you for being available and online. Leslie's with the Department of Natural Resources with the state. And I think so oftentimes people think of the Iditarod Trail as 1,000 miles because they're focused on the race that is 1,000 miles, but yet it's more than twice that long as far as branches of the trail. Leslie, mm-hmm. How is the DNR involved in this effort at trail preservation and enhancement? What's going on from the state's perspective?
Well, from the state's perspective, the Iditarod Trail Committee, the race folks, in 2007 received a grant from the Alaska Trail Initiative to help fund with DNR positions to actually map and make sure there are easements all the way to Nome. And the Iditarod is a system of trails. It's not one trail. And so the race route is, you know, one route to Nome, but there's actually a whole system of trails that connect the villages and towns in the interior.
I know that there's also an effort that's modeled after mm-hmm. the Appalachian Trail project called iTrek, and I'm not sure if the state is involved in this or where this initiative is coming from, but it's teaching sort of place-based education about familiarizing teachers and students about the culture and history of the area that they are with an eye toward better investment if you know more about your area and your community. Can you talk a little about that, Leslie? I hope I'm not putting you on the spot.
Actually, Judy would be better at answering that one.
Okay, great.
I'll take that question.
Thank you.
That is something that the Alliance working with the Chugach Forest and BLM have taken on, and that is really is based off of Appalachian Trail Forest Trail to Every Classroom and Forest for Every Classroom from the Forest Service, and it is a year-long multidisciplinary professional development series for educators, and it's aimed at providing some inspiration and knowledge and skills that makes, you know, teaching really more effective and exciting in a place-based way. And it's a place-based and service learning curriculum-based approach to it. And the teachers that we have selected in our pilot year come from communities from Seward to Nome. It includes, you know, Girdwood and Anchorage and Mat-Su and Galena, Nome, and Seward. And they are just provided some teaching techniques and ideas, and then it's up to the teacher then to use their local resources and develop curriculum that gets children involved in the outdoors, in the Iditarod Trail, and in their community. And
you mentioned service. Are they getting out and doing projects on the trail where they're helping to maintain it, or what's that?
It varies, and some of them, and it's really up to the teachers to develop that, and it ranges the trails or the projects this year include identification and marking the trail. There is a group in Seward that is looking at one of the streams that crosses near the trail area that has a kind of a low salmon run, so they're doing some scientific studies to see what might, if there's some watershed issues there, that and doing some water quality. Some are looking at developing historical timelines. Others are getting involved in local community planning because the trail right behind their school is being damaged by some utility development. So it's really up to the teacher to figure out from their grade level and the kind of the issues that are involved in the trail at the time. And the teachers range from kindergarten to high school. And so it's a very adaptable program.
And when did it start in 2008, this effort in the classroom, or is it just getting started?
No, it just got started. It was really the August of 2010. And we're just in our first year. It includes three training. You get a fall, a summer, fall, and spring. We've had the first two, and our next training will be in Nome in April. And so we will graduate our first set of teachers, and the teachers have been so embracing of this project that they have jumped right into their projects before, just almost immediately after the first training, and not even waiting for all three trainings to take place.
A while back, Kevin, you'd mentioned marking, that there's an effort to improve the marking on the trail. And I was reading about the airdrop of materials, how mm-hmm. 8-foot poles were parachuted out. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
Right. Over many sections of the trail, there's absolutely no vegetation at all, and it's prone to blizzards and whiteouts where you lose your way. The traditional marking that had been used out there were three long poles lashed together into a tripod form. Because there is such a need for the tripods and a huge number of materials in these very remote places, one of the opportunities we had, because BLM works closely with the Alaska Fire Service, was to use paracargo operation to drop bundles of these tripods out into the area. And having just gone out 3 weeks ago and helped set them up, mm-hmm. I realized how important it was for us to do that, because just to get out there with our snow machines and gas and that sort of thing, rather than us being trail breakers, I think the trail almost broke us. It's pretty rough running out on these routes in the wintertime when they haven't been opened up. There's a lot of overflow, and it just beats up people and machines. And the number of poles that are put out there, basically the interval is one every 500 feet over these segments. So we have massive distances, massive quantities. It's not as hard on the coast, in coastal areas, for instance, to get out to these places. But the segments between Ophir and Shagluck is something like a 225-mile segment, and there's nobody who lives in that area. So we used paracargo to get these out. And then folks from the Iditarod Alliance provided some grant money to the community of Takotna, and we went out there with Dick Newton, who people may have heard of before. He's and his wife are in the Iditarod Hall of Fame. He's an 80-year-old, and we went out with him and his grandson and three high school kids and worked for a week setting up these tripods and set up about 30 miles of tripods.
How long do they last? How often do you have to replace them when you set up one of these tripods?
These tripods are actually the landscaping timbers from Home Depot. but they're treated with a wood preservative on them, and so they can last for up to 10 or 15 years, whereas a regular spruce pole could easily be blown down and not last for even 5 years,
right?
Which is what we've seen on the coast.
Well, we're going to talk a lot more. There's a lot more to discuss about the Iditarod Trail, and we've got a caller that wants to talk to us about riding with Joe Reddington Sr. And we'll do that in just a moment when Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. First National Bank Alaska, serving Alaskans' financial needs for nearly a century. Member FDIC, equal housing lender. And by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend, and today we're talking about the Iditarod Trail and the fact that it's more than 100 years old. We're going to take a caller in a moment, but first we had a caller who had a question about why Crow Pass is used instead of Indian Creek Pass.
There was competition between the two passes. Goodwin, who is the original trail route finder, liked the Crow Pass route, and this was before the days that Anchorage had even been settled. So Anchorage wasn't on the map. The trail users and trail builders were looking for the closest connection between Girdwood and Kinnick, and Crow Pass was right there. In 1915, Anchorage was settled for the Alaska Railroad, and then at that time, a lot of the emphasis port facilities were developed, and so it became easier to use the Ship Creek Indian route, which was the main link for Anchorage. It also took a number of years for the trails and railroad to be built around the south side of Chugach State Park nowadays, and so the only route was the Girdwood over to Indian and then Ship Pass.
1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. Locally, it's 550-8422. And now we're going to hear from Dale, who's in Eagle River and had what I bet was a thrilling ride with Joe Reddington Sr. Dale?
Hi, Lori. First, I'd like to thank the station for programs like this, and I hope people will write their politicians about the possible cutting of funding for these sorts of things. It would be a crime. Hi, Kevin. This is Dale Myers.
Hi, Dale.
I'm a president of the Wasilla-Kinnick Historical Society. I'm on the board for the IHTA. 22-year volunteer with the Iditarod, but in 1996, as an amateur, had a chance to ride a dog sled team all the way to Nome, in company with Joe Reddington and half a dozen other rookies, and we were not racing. We left the day after the racers left, and there was no chance we were going to overtake them, though it took us 20 days to get there. but it was just an incredible experience. First of all, every village we pulled into, the first people out were the children and the elders. The children to see the strangers and the dogs, and the elders to meet and greet Joe Reddington Sr., who was known to all of them and loved by all of them. And every single village, there was pretty much a small potlatch thrown for us. And we got to hear all of these amazing stories that, that predated the race and, you know, the actual Native history on the trail prior. It was a once-in-a-lifetime experience, and I'll never forget it.
It sounds phenomenal. And one of the things that I wanted to ask about, thank you so much for the call, Dale, and that great story, is the idea of collecting the stories. I think that that is part of what's being undertaken here, and I don't know if that's a question for you, Kevin, or Judy, or Leslie, but I understand that part of the preservation and restoration is also collecting the stories of the trail. How is that being undertaken, and what stories are you collecting?
I'll let Judy start first, if she'd like.
Yes, I'll do that, actually, in a couple different ways. One, we have done some interpretive signs working with some communities to kind of tell the story in that way, and we do want to work with some more communities in their museums and their visitor centers to both, you know, collect and help tell the stories of from their area. We also are close to be publishing a book that Hannah Motoro write about the history of the trail, and in that we highlight a number of stories from some we've taken from histories and the old newspapers and up to current times, and sharing some of the adventurism and interesting stories along the trail. So we are in close to publication of a book on the history of the trail. Also working with the Sherry Norton and her husband on publishing and editing the Goodwin manuscripts, and so the first kind of scouting of the trail, we want to get that information out. So we have a couple publications that will be available soon, just to share with people.
And I wanted to ask about Dale had mentioned on his phenomenal trip with Joe Reddington Sr. that they visited villages and were met with a great ceremony. Are there efforts underway in the villages that are on the route to talk with elders and collect some of their stories as well?
That is a goal of ours, to do that and to you know, work with the communities, working through the locals. I know the McGrath and their museum there have collected a number of stories and information in that area, and that is one of the goals of, you know, during our centennial is to engage the communities even more.
I was going to mention that the Toccheq Historic Society, which is out of McGrath, has a beautiful little museum put together by a number of dedicated volunteers, including Sally and Ray Collins, who've lived up in that country since the late 50s, and they lived with folks over in Nikolai and documented their use of the technology for weaving baskets and et cetera, that were the precedent or preceded the things that we do now but might be doing out of fiberglass and whatnot. And they're actually going to be having, every year they have a little benefit dinner right around the sled dog race, the Tuesday night that the racers come through McGrath. They'll be having a benefit dinner at the Toccheq Historic Society, and if anybody happens to be up in McGrath and wants to come out for that, or at any other time anybody's in McGrath, it's a beautiful museum that has a wealth of information about that whole region, both the native prehistory and the mining settlements and other settlement after that that happened. Folks in McGrath are also putting together a video as part of the centennial celebration that explains the relationship between the trail itself and the growth of the community.
1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or locally in the Anchorage area, 550-8422. What has been lost on the trail? I know there's been efforts to restore some of the historic buildings, but there's been things lost to wildfire and I imagine just extreme weather. What has been lost, and do you plan to replicate those buildings, or are they just lost?
There's over the years, the type of building styles that were used weren't necessarily, you'd have sod roofs and logs that were laid down on the ground, that sort of thing. They really didn't lend themselves to long-term preservation. So a number of roadhouses have just really literally crumbled into the ground. But there are relics that are still out there on the ground that remain from those old installations. There's a couple different sites, though, where some of the last remaining safety cabins still stand, and I think I'll let Leslie talk about that a little bit in a moment. For instance, an old safety cabin on the edge of the Squintna River, and the river was lapping right up in front of its door, and those guys moved it. And there's another one called Don's Cabin, too. There was the Pioneer Roadhouse, which was around the Farewell Lake area, was burnt over by the Turquoise Lake fire this past year. So there's probably nails in the ground and bits and pieces of porcelain and scrap and that sort of thing, but that's pretty much it's all that's left now from that, whereas previously there was walls still standing, although the roof was caved in and whatnot. So there's also in places, too, you can see the actual work that was done on the ground for the trail, and that's pretty exciting. Down in Girdwood, it's a great example. Along Crow Creek Road, there's still corduroy in the ground, and working with the community down there, the community opened a section of that trail up and rebuilt it, so you can still see the old logs laid down on the ground and that sort of thing. So it's the ravages of time takes its toll, but there's still some neat treasures out there in the ground.
And Leslie, do you want to chime in here and talk a little bit about what the DNR is doing to help preserve some of these areas?
Yeah, the DNR is involved in mapping, verifying, and creating easements for the trail, as well as also documenting the historic structures that are still out there and what needs to be done to hopefully preserve them. And this last year we did, for the Squintna Crossing Safety Cabin, which is where the Iditarod crosses the Squintna River, unfortunately the river changed course and the main channel eroded and took away the doghouses and the barn, but the shelter cabin was still there. And so we did an emergency move to move it back up onto the bluff. And this next weekend and over the summer, we restored the cabin. And then this next weekend, we'll be going out and finishing it up and putting a stove back in so it can actually be used as a safety cabin.
Fantastic. We're going to take a call now. We've got Bill in Willow, who is a two-time Iditarod finisher. Hi, Bill.
Yes. Hello. Great program, and I really appreciate it. What I wanted to call in about was I wanted to mention Rod Perry's books. He has the book called Trailbreakers, Volume 1 and 2. And the Volume 1 book, he goes into extensive research, how the trails were formed in Canada and Alaska. And then in Volume 2, he has a detailed accounts of the first Iditarod. He was involved with Joe Reddington and the people that actually started the Iditarod. And so he was in person, there. And he recounts it. And I guarantee once you read the Volume 2, you won't be able to put it down. And there's so much information there that just never heard before. So that's what I wanted to say. And that was Rod Perry. And the books are Trailbreakers, Volume 1 and 2. And thank you for taking my call.
Well, Bill, hold on just a second. I wanted to ask you, you're a two-time finisher of the race. How have you traveled the trail more than twice? And what are your thoughts about it?
Well, first time I ran was 1986, and that year there was no snow, bare ground, rocks, and tree stumps all the way. Mm. And then in 1990, when I ran again, it was nothing but deep snow. So I've had, for me, it's been the best experience of my life. While you're out there doing it, you're questioning your sanity. But then once you make it through, and it's for me, it was the best experience ever, and it really pushes you to the limits. You don't realize how much the human will can propel you forward, and just the fact that you're able to, we have a trail like this that allows you to be out there in Mother Nature is an experience that it costs money to do it, but it's the experience is something money can't buy. And for me, it's just been, you know, I mean, it's just been an excellent, excellent experience. So, and another thing, once you travel the trail on a dog team, you know, you're not insulated like you are on a snow machine or an airplane, and you're seeing it at the ground level, and it really gives you a whole different perspective. And when you can get in tune with animals and Mother Nature, I mean, that is, it's just indescribable, you know, and it's something you'll look back on forever, and no one can ever take that away from you because you did it yourself. And regardless of how how you finished, you know, I consider myself a winner and very fortunate for the experience. And I just want to thank all the volunteers and everyone that's been involved in it all this time, because you know it's a once in a lifetime, or one, the only experience you can have in the world is, you know, like the Iditarod. So that makes it very, very, very unique.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much for the call, Bill. Great. It's great to hear from folks who have traveled the trail, those tough individuals. I can't imagine it myself. But I'm glad that people do, and we have those great stories to relay. We're going to take another call, 1-800-478-8255 or 1-800-478-TALK. Locally, 550-8422 is the number. We're talking about the Iditarod Trail, and I want to get to, in just a few moments, the National Historic, in the designation that it's received and how that all works. But let's talk a little more about the tourism aspect of it. And we've got Lori in Wasilla, who's with Sky Trekking Alaska, who has a company that takes folks out on the trail. Hi, Lori.
Hi, good morning.
Good morning. And tell me, first of all, how long has your company been doing these ventures out on the trail?
Actually, we've had the opportunity to be on the trail since 1994. And also, I'd really like to thank you for this opportunity. I almost got teary-eyed listening to Bill from Willow. It's just amazing what the guys who travel on a dog team to Nome. It's just blow mind.
And Lori, in the years that you've been taking folks out to see the Iditarod Trail, what's changed? What are people looking for when they want this experience?
Well, I don't know that a whole lot has changed. What we see is, you know, we see people who, you know, they've thought about this for, you know, it's been a dream of their life to go on the Iditarod Trail, and everybody seems to know about Nome, and they learn about it in school, and they hear about the Iditarod Trail sled dog race, you know, is mainly, you know, when they really want to focus on the trail. And, you know, it's people who are, you know, everyday people who just want to experience Alaska in the winter and see just what the mushers, you know, go through to get from Anchorage to Nome. And I don't think anybody just really even understands what they're getting themselves into till they get out on that trail and really see how remote it is. I mean, it's almost unheard of anywhere else in our modern world. That's what's so amazing about the trail.
Are you mainly seeing folks from the United States, or where are these people coming from?
We get people from the United States. We get people from Switzerland, Australia, the UK. Usually it's a mixed bag every year. We get people from all over the world and the United States.
And are they surprised that they aren't flying to some luxury lodge somewhere, that it is so remote and so rustic when you get out there on the trail?
Oh, they're absolutely mesmerized. They can't believe it. And I think one of the challenges for us is to, you know, provide the nicest and most comfortable accommodations and meals and things like that that we can, but I think everybody, when they get on the trail, they're just so amazed that they have a warm bed and some great food to eat in the evening, and it's just amazing.
Well, thank you so much for giving us a call and letting us know. I know that there's a lot of people that do go out on the trail, and one of the things that I am curious about is how people are traveling beyond just out with teams during race season. Are people, I know that there's a bike race that traverses part of the trail, people hike part of the trail. Are people going out by horseback, or are there other ways that people are using the trail and traveling?
Well, I want to say right now, it's actually one of the busiest used routes in Alaska. 30,000 people from Wasilla drove down on it today to Anchorage to go to work, because the Iditarod Trail used to cross basically where the Glen Highway Bridge is right now.
Oh, fascinating.
Mushers used to cross the ice right at that location across the Kinnick River, which is kind of a hairy thought when you think about it to begin with. So, but you've got runs like the Crow Pass Marathon. You've got people who go out and hunt on sections of the trail. Out of Nome, there's road sections of the trail that run out to the famous coined place, the Last Train to Nowhere. So you can do driving tours out there if you like. Chugach National Forest, many of the segments run through there. The Alaska Railroad, the trail follows the Alaska Railroad, or vice versa. So people riding the train to Seward are actually on the trail also.
So it sounds like folks traveling the highway and on the railroad are all getting in touch with their inner musher on the Iditarod Trail. And we're going to be talking more about the trail and efforts to keep it preserved as Talk of Alaska continues.
Talk of Alaska comes to you from APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network, and is made possible with support from this APRN member station. The State of Alaska Department of Revenue reminds you to file online now for your 2011 PFD. Paper applications are available at the same 270 statewide locations as last year. More information at alaska.pfd.gov. This message sponsored by the State of Alaska.
Ich bin gar nicht auf den Norden geschlüten Indian Trust Land, am IIM Account am Big Schlüten, was so gegenüber geschlüten Indian Trust der Grund, nun Norden Klamm, was Account am Big Klamm. Die Ugo wird auch in New Mountain Italy nicht $3.4 billion Settlement am. Auch doch die Ugo wird allen am Settlement am Gang in Narotti nicht. Die Ugo nach Kutschiv nicht kann nicht starr weg gehen. Website am IndianTrust.com am Bio Mountain, was doch noch 1-800-961-6109.
Welcome back to Talk of Alaska. I'm Lori Townsend. 1-800-478-8255, 1-800-478-TALK, or locally 550-8422 is the number to join our conversation. We've got about, 8 minutes or so left, but I'd sure love to hear from some people in remote parts of the state who have used the trail or maybe are using the trail right now and using it for part of their travel. Kevin, there's a way for folks to get involved this weekend when the ceremonial start of the race happens here in Anchorage. Talk a little bit about this.
Right. One of the ways that we like to send the dogs off to Nome, this is BLM. One of the roles that we play is that the ceremonial start out of Anchorage runs through the trails, Chester Creek Greenbelt, and then runs over to the Campbell Track facility in Anchorage. And there's plenty of space out there. We've got parking at Kassoon Elementary, and shuttle buses that are going to run throughout the Campbell Track facility so people can view the mushers at different locations. They can get up and close, not quite the hubbub that you're going to find downtown. Still kind of a fun atmosphere nonetheless, but you can get up close and watch the mushers with their dogs come on by. And we'll also have displays about the historic trail, working with the Iditarod Alliance out at the Campbell Creek Science Center, so people can come on in, learn more about the historic trail, warm up, have some hot cocoa and cookies and that sort of thing, and then go out and see their favorite mushers close up as they warm up and limber up for their run to Nome. So we'd really encourage people to come on out, and it'll probably be a nice day. And well, it's March, and the days are getting long and warmer here, so
hallelujah.
Come on out.
We're all glad to see that. tell us about how a trail gets the National Historic Trail designation. What's the process? There's only 18 in the nation, which seems amazing in itself. So how does this happen? It must be quite a process.
Right. These are, in a sense, kind of the cream of the crop trails that are National Historic Trails. There's two types of trails in the National Trail System, National Scenic Trails like the Appalachian and the Continental Divide Trail, and then National Historic Trails like the Iditarod, the Lewis and Clark. So these are trails of nationwide significance. And like I mentioned, the Iditarod is America's last great gold rush trail. And one of the differences compared to all the other ones is it's a winter trail. And also, rather than many of these other historic trails relied on horses, we rely on dogs up here. So two really different, unique things. But back in the mid-1970s, when the National Trails Act was first established, there is a piece of the legislation to study the gold rush trails across Alaska. And a number of the gold rush trails were studied, including the Chilkoot Trail and some of the other ones up in the Fairbanks area. The Iditarod Trail was selected as being meritorious, and through law, it was designated as a National Historic Trail in 1978. And then the Bureau of Land Management, the state of Alaska, and other parties worked on a comprehensive management plan, which was adopted ultimately in 1986. And that's been our guiding document since that time that identifies strategies and segments to work on.
The trail system is 2,400 miles. Is all of it designated National Historic Trail, or how much of it is?
Well, something that's a little bit different than a National Scenic Trail is that, of course, we're different in Alaska than all the other National Historic Trails. In the lower 48, a National Historic Trail is usually maybe a mile of ruts over here and cut through the rocks or inscription or something like that. But here in Alaska, we really still have lots of public land. But nonetheless, National Historic Trails, whether or not it's accessible to the public is really up to the individual landowner themselves. And then the National Scenic Trails, like the Appalachian, they're managed by one agency, say the Park Service or the Forest Service. So we're different with this trail in that there's a whole bunch of different, it's a potluck of different landowners and partners who are interested in the management of the trail. So no one entity manages the trail. BLM is the coordinator for the trail, responsible for facilitating implementation of the comprehensive management plan. But it's really up to the cooperation of the various parties, and we've mentioned some of them today, the Forest Service, Fish and Wildlife Service, Department of Natural Resources, and I also want to say that the Iditarod Trail Committee over the years has played a really critical role in keeping the trail open.
Well, I want to thank you, Kevin. Kevin Keeler has been the in-studio guest today. He's the administrator with the Iditarod National Historic Trail for the Bureau of Land Management. Also, we had Judy Bittner and Leslie Schick on the phone with us. Thank you so much to BD Trantina and Josh Edge, who operated the phones, and Dave Waldron, our engineer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Thanks a lot.
Talk of Alaska is made possible by this member station of the Alaska Public Radio Network, by Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals, Wells Fargo Bank, N.A., and by ANSEP, the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program, where every year Alaska Natives from all corners of the state graduate and become engineers, scientists, and physicians. Students can get involved as early as middle school, then move to the University of Alaska Anchorage, Fairbanks, or Southeast in a program based on skill building, collaboration, and community. Learn more at ANSEP.net. This message sponsored by the Alaska Native Science and Engineering Program. One answer to our state's declining oil production? Port McKenzie Rail Project. The link from the Alaska Railroad to a deepwater port will bring billions in mineral production and thousands of jobs. This message sponsored by the Matanuska Susitna Borough. Views expressed on this program are those of the participants and not necessarily those of APRN, this station, or its underwriters. Today's program is available online at aprn.org. CD copies are available by calling 550-8400.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.